Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Hello and a warm welcome to Africa Link with me, Assumpta Latos. Coming up, Nigerian military claim they are making progress in the fight against Boko Haram. Are Nigerians regaining confidence in their armed forces?
The Nigerian military, they have always been known for effectiveness and efficiency.
They give lots of conflicting stories, and it makes it difficult for me to have confidence in what the military tells us.
And the opposition in Kenya has welcomed the High Court move of striking out parts of a controversial bill.
We are gratified that 10 sections of the Security Amendment Law have been declared unconstitutional, null and void, and inapplicable in a modern democratic society.
These two stories and more coming up right here at Africa Link.
Top story.
We begin in northeastern Nigeria, where a girl as young as 10 has blown herself up, killing herself and four others. This has caused fears that Boko Haram is using kidnapped girls as suicide bombers. Over the past few days, Nigerian military has been claiming a series of victories over the militant Islamist group Boko Haram. The military say large swathes of territory have been recaptured from the group, while many of its fighters have been seized or killed. Our Lagos correspondent Samuel Okoya has been finding out whether Nigerians are starting to regain confidence in their country's military.
The successes the Nigerian military says it recorded in the last days is what the government promised Nigerians after elections were postponed due to security concerns as a result of the Boko Haram insurgency. President Goodluck Jonathan says the military's success will guarantee security for the elections.
For now, about 3 states are in the enclave of Boko Haram where conducting elections may be difficult, but this period will give them the opportunity to clean up the 3 states. So we will surely conduct elections as scheduled.
In the last days, the military has recaptured key towns such as Mongunu and Baga. Both towns have military bases, and hundreds or more people were killed in Baga in early January. The loss of these two towns were part of the reasons that many Nigerians lost confidence in the army. For Lagos resident Mayowa Adebola, the military victory was not enough to restore that confidence.
For me personally, it's sometimes difficult to believe them because in the past they've said lots of things which weren't correct, so as not to lose face in the face of Nigerian people, in which after a while we find out that these things are not true. The other day they were talking about ceasefire. Less than 6 hours after they said ceasefire had been agreed, Boko Haram went on killing spree. So they give lots of conflicting stories, and it makes it difficult for me to have confidence in what the military tells us.
But another Lagos resident, Otdo Abasi Ekong, says that he believes in the army's ability.
Yeah, the Nigerian military, they have always been known for effectiveness and efficiency. It's about proper deployment. It's about ensuring that the necessary arsenal and the logistics and equipment required are put in place. And so you can see that even in a few days or so, you've seen what they're doing. So all they need is the commander-in-chief to just give that backing, and all required service chiefs and officers in charge give the right tactics and the right logistics and equipment, and Nigerian military will do what is in their order.
The military attributes its recent successes to the new delivery of armament. The question many are asking is why it took so long to properly arm the army.
Sam Olukoya reporting. Let's hear now an analyst view of those claims of progress by the Nigerian army in the struggle against Boko Haram. Manji Cheto is vice president of Teneo Intelligence, a risk analyst group based in London in the UK. She has just returned from Nigeria, and Mark Caldwell asked her what evidence she had seen that the tide was turning in the military's favour.
It's quite clear from speaking to contacts in Nigeria that there's been a significant turn in the counterinsurgency efforts. This is actually has been boosted actually by two main things. The first being the equipment that the military has been requesting for has now actually finally reached soldiers on the front line. So that has made a difference. And then the second thing is also the multinational force that has finally been assembled by Nigeria, Niger, Chad and Cameroon. That has actually helped to sort of close down or intensify the counterinsurgency efforts. And the question, however, that a lot of people are asking is why now for an insurgency that has been fought for 6 years? Why has it taken so long for things to change? And the local sentiment certainly seems to be that elections are the main driver behind the change in the tide.
The reason President Goodluck Jonathan, or rather the Electoral Commission, gave for postponing the elections was poor security in the northeast. So do you then see security improving in that part of the country by polling day?
I think what the military and also the government has made quite clear is, yes, they don't think that they're going to completely neutralise the Boko Haram threat by elections on May 28th. However, they're certainly trying to effectively regain some of the territories that have been lost and to create safe pockets within particularly the four states, Yobe, Adamawa and Borno and Jigawa, that have come under intensified attacks by Boko Haram. They're trying to create safe pockets in those areas that allow them to actually conduct elections and to actually have the polls fairly secured. And that seems to be the goal rather than completely neutralising the threat from Boko Haram.
The UN Security Council has not yet given its approval to this multinational force. Let's assume that that does happen. Can you see this new force altering the course of this conflict?
Certainly, because, you know, one of the things, if we cast our minds back to May 2013, when Nigeria first imposed a state of emergency in the three northeastern states, effectively what happened was Boko Haram was pushed from the urban centres in these three states into the remote areas, and a lot of those remote areas also bordered Cameroon, Chad and Niger. So effectively, when Nigerian troops kind of pushed Boko Haram out of Nigerian territory, they went and were able to kind of regroup in areas of Cameroon. And the lack of a multinational force meant that the group was actually able to operate without any level of impunity or any kind of pushback on the bordering side. So the fact that we now have multinational force suggests that, you know, you should be actually seeing an improvement. And like I said, the evidence suggests that actually there is an improvement. So as long as, you know, they kind of sustain the momentum, then I think we might just be seeing a glimmer of hope in the counterinsurgency efforts.
Manji Cheto, Vice President of Tineo Intelligence in London. You're listening to Deutsche Welle's Africa Link, coming to you from Bonn.
News, analysis and feature reports, all that here on Africa Link.
In Kenya, the country's High Court has overturned 10 new laws, which were part of a raft of controversial legislation that the government claimed was aimed at tightening national security. The measures were signed into law by President Uhuru Kenyatta in December and were condemned by the opposition as draconian. James Shimanyula was in court.
The five judges spent more than 5 hours reading their bulk judgment, which among other things described 10 of the new laws as unconstitutional. The unconstitutional laws include sections that imposes harsh fines on media outlets that broadcast images deemed offensive by the government. Other clauses limit the number of refugees allowed in Kenya and allow the suspect to be held without trial for 360 days, 4 times longer than before. One of the judges, Isaac Lenaola, read out the quashing of some of the new laws.
Section 66 of the Penal Code is hereby declared unconstitutional for violating the freedom of expression in the media, guaranteed under Articles 33 and 34 of the Constitution. Section 64 of the Prevention of Terrorism Act is also declared unconstitutional.
Reflecting on the judgment, Moses Wetangula of the opposition's Coalition for Reforms and Democracy Code Leadership said,
We are gratified that 10 sections of the Security Amendment Law have been declared unconstitutional, null and void, and inapplicable in a modern democratic society. Laws that were brought relating to the freedom of the media, the right to a fair trial, have all been declared to be an assault on the Constitution.
Mwangi Njoroge, a government lawyer who represented Kenya's Attorney General, however, says you'll appeal the judgment.
There are some provisions which have been declared unconstitutional by the court. We want to examine them in detail. We are going to scrutinize them. They have been declared unconstitutional as of now. The respondent has a right to appeal if they feel discontented.
Ben Mulwa, the Kenya National Representative of Victims of Terror Attacks, was not happy with the declaration of the new laws as unconstitutional.
The law that we currently have did not have very specific provisions for fighting terrorism, because that's where our primary concern is. In our view, there needs to be extensive consultation so that we are able to come up with laws that truly address the challenges that we are facing.
Jonathan Murathe, a Nairobi high school teacher who was in court to listen to the judgment, had this to say.
In my view, the general judgment was fantastic. What the government should have done initially is to set laws to equip the police, secure our borders, and protect the terrorists from coming into the country.
According to constitutional experts, if the case continues, it could go up to the Supreme Court, the country's highest court.
That was James Shimanyula reporting.
Africa on the move.
Power outages are a major problem in South Africa. They are so bad that South African heavy industry has been told to reduce consumption by 10% as the state-owned power firm Eskom struggles to keep the lights on. But one South African citizen has been able to bid goodbye to blackouts by switching entirely to renewable sources of energy. The results impressed him so much that he is now building similar systems commercially. This report by Jan Philip Schluter has been adapted for Africa Link by Sonia Din.
Years ago, Ines Druckmeyer happily said goodbye to the electrical monopoly of South Africa's public utility Eskom. Druckmeyer, his wife, and three children live off solar and wind energy in Pretoria, one of South Africa's capital cities. But he makes clear he's no eco-freak.
We don't do the Greenpeace thing. Yeah, put all the garages automate. We use vacuum cleaners. You know, the wife and the daughter uses their blow dryers and curlers. The kids have television sets in their rooms and they have normal gaming devices. And we have five fridges throughout the system, which I think is an abnormal type of number for any type of household. So we don't really limit ourselves.
Ines Druckmeyer could be the envy of many South Africans as the country is suffering from an electricity crisis. Since 2008, Eskom has scheduled frequent rolling blackouts to prevent short supply from crashing the grid. The procedure, known as load shedding, deliberately shuts down electricity over certain intervals in order to prevent a total blackout. If South Africans could elect a most hated phrase, load shedding might be it. But Druckmeyer doesn't have to deal with this problem. His unassuming stone house has been completely off the grid for years now. Druckmeyer points to his energy devices.
This is a power array, and basically what that consists of is 24 panels, which is mounted on a rotating actuator. In the mornings, it pitches the panels vertically into the sun, and throughout the day, they would rotate from east to west, and during midday, you would typically find the panels in very close to horizontal position.
In addition to the solar panels, Druckmeyer has also installed a wind turbine. And just in case, he's got 16 large yellow batteries. So when the sun makes itself scarce and the air is still, his family can continue to use all their electrical devices for an entire day.
They are installed next door. There's a special battery room We try and keep it as clean as possible, as this is the most expensive part of the system.
But this off-the-grid setup wasn't completely voluntary. 7 years ago, when Dreckmeyer bought his property in a hilly, green area outside Pretoria, he had actually wanted to connect to the grid. But that would have cost 20,000 euros. And the lines would have run above ground, ruining the wonderful view he enjoys so much. So the electrical engineer came up with a plan. Although it required a 35,000 euro outlay, nearly twice the cost of connecting to the grid, after only 4 years, the system had paid for itself. And now electricity for the Dreckmeyers is practically free. Arnus Dreckmeyer says more people in sunny South Africa should do the same.
If you install 10,000 devices like this throughout South Africa, it boils down to a 50 megawatt power plant that you've built. If that does not make a difference, then I really don't know what would.
In the meantime, Dreckmeyer has turned his personal idea into a business. His high-tech solutions company also advises people who want to break free from the electrical grid. And if more South Africans get off the grid and into renewable energy, it really could make a difference. Not only for the planet, but also for the people, who wouldn't have to suffer anymore from load shedding. But as with so many things, in the end, it all comes down to the money.
That report was written by Jan-Philipp Schluter. To Addis Ababa now, where South Sudan's warring factions have opened their latest round of peace talks. Regional mediators have given President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar until March 5th to reach a peace agreement. The two sides are also committed to setting up a transitional unity government by July 9th. Mark Caldwell asked our correspondent in Addis Ababa, Coleto Njoi, what had emerged from the first day of these talks.
The first day of these final peace talks, that's what the IGAD-led mediation calls it. It's the final phase of the peace talks. What happened today was just a reassurance from both warring factions, that is the government of South Sudan and the rebel faction led by former Vice President Riek Machar, that they are ready to recommit themselves to the February agreement that the warring principals signed, and they are ready to work as hard as they can to make sure that by March 5th, they have at least a comprehensive agreement as far as the transitional government is concerned. However, there were repeated warnings from the IGAD mediation that March 5th, beyond March 5th, they will not be allowed to continue with their negotiations. So it was just a recommitment and a reminder that time is running out for the warring factions.
At what level are these talks being conducted?
If we remember very well, the February agreement that was signed by President Salva Kiir and the rebel leader Riek Machar, according to the agreement, it was supposed to be the two warring principals leading their teams this time for the final phase of the negotiations. However, what we have seen today is that the two principals were missing. President Salva Kiir did not come and rebel leader Riek Machar did not come. So what we are left with are the chief negotiators from both sides leading a negotiating team that are expected to keep discussing different issues that may lead to a transitional government. It was supposed to be a very high-level discussion. However, it has gone back to what it was before.
Do we know when Riek Machar and Salva Kiir are going to meet face-to-face?
There has been no confirmation from both sides whether these two will meet face-to-face. There has been no confirmation. All they are saying is that they are here to negotiate on behalf of their principals, and that's what we have got from them. So what even the IGAD itself, the one leading the mediation, does not know whether these warring principals are going to appear at any time. So all we are looking at is the March 5th deadline. Hopefully, maybe they hope the two principals will appear by then, but nobody certainly knows.
Fighting broke out 15 months ago, and in the meantime, numerous ceasefire deals have been struck and then broken. Are there any promising signs that this won't happen this time round?
There is no certainty, because even today, both factions, as they were recommitting publicly, they kept accusing each other of breaching the cessation of hostilities agreement. We know that even after the February agreement was signed, Few hours later, fighting continued, and we have got a reconfirmation from both sides that they are not withdrawing their troops from anywhere. The rebel faction actually confirms that it still occupies some areas in South Sudan and it is not going to disarm. So still, the cessation of hostilities agreement that was signed, that is in January 2014, still lies, in a limbo. There is no certainty, because one of the issues that was raised today was that the IGAD-led mediation was supposed to come up with a matrix of implementation of the cessation of hostilities agreement. However, the government of South Sudan today pointed publicly that even IGAD has failed because it has not even implemented this matrix. So the Addis Ababa talks do not conform with what is happening on the ground in South Sudan.
That was Coletta Wanjoy speaking from Addis Ababa.
Making a difference.
Making a difference this week takes us to Tamale in northern Ghana, where we pay a visit to a local blacksmith. A true craftsman has been supplying poorer members of the community with essential utensils they cannot afford to buy elsewhere. Maxwell Suk has met him, and here is his report.
That is the sound coming out from the shop of Isaka Haruna, a blacksmith in Tamale. He's lighting up coal in his small porch to burn a metal over the fire to produce a coal pot. In front of his shop are some of Isaka's handiworks, bowls, buckets, dustbins and watering cans. Sweat drips from the face of the 60-year-old craftsman as he tells me how he became a blacksmith.
I used to be a farmer, but then I realized that I could design little things such as hoes, coal pots, machetes, garbage bins, and watering cans. So I told my father that I wanted to become a blacksmith, and he allowed me to learn the trade. That's how I started.
He is known popularly as Mbamachele, meaning blacksmith in the native language. He uses scrap metals and abandoned aluminium zinc to produce simple tools that otherwise would have been unaffordable to the local people.
Many people come here every day to buy my items, especially the poor people in this city. I also send the products to villages. They've got no money to buy luxurious products, especially cooking utensils, so I provide them an alternative.
Isaka currently has 5 apprentices. Alhassan Awal is one of them. For him, learning a trade is a great opportunity.
I can design so many things. Can't you see? That is a bucket. I can do watering cans, coal pots, and hand washing containers for schools. If people bring leaking utensils, I can repair them too.
Isaka has a regular customer based around Tamale. Salfu Karim, a vegetable grower in Tamale, for example, uses watering cans from Isaka's workshop for his crops during the dry season. He has been a vegetable farmer for the past 30 years using the watering cans.
It's good to have them. These are local-made tools. If we have them, in fact, it helps a lot. In fact, it's not easy to acquire a pumping machine. And even this water hose, some of us do use water hose. It's the same thing, but you can acquire this one at a moderate price.
Isaka and his team create what his customers want. Due to the Ebola crisis in the nearby West African states of Guinea, Sierra Leone and Liberia, hand-washing basins for schools and offices have, for example, been in high demand. They even gave them the name Ebola containers.
Maxwell Suk there reporting, and Making a Difference will be back at the same time next week.
For more about Africa Link, go to dw.de/AfricaLink. Find out about Africa Link's partner stations, send us your feedback in a text message, and sign up for our newsletter. dw.de/AfricaLink.
And now a reminder of our main stories. The Nigerian military and their counterparts from neighboring Chad are claiming to have retaken towns and villages held by Boko Haram for months. Kenya's High Court has thrown out parts of new anti-terrorism legislation, including restrictions on the media. And peace talks between the warring factions in South Sudan have resumed in Addis Ababa. And that's it for today. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow for another edition of Africa Link. For questions or comments, send us a text message to +491609575910 and email to feedback.africa@dw.de or a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110 Bonn, Germany. Till tomorrow then, it's me, Assumpta Latus. Have a good day and goodbye.